On the record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
Let's get you back to the front pages of this morning's newspapers. It's mostly budget related, but there is one story that doesn't lead, or one paper rather, which doesn't lead with any budget story, which is the Sunday Times this morning, which says that Fianna Fáil is facing a backlash over the decision to deploy Simon Coveney and Jack Chambers to that much-discussed event in Armagh next month, marking the centenary of partition. There are several Fianna Fáil TDs who say that they're angry at the government's decision, and they say that they intend to tell Micheál Martin at Fianna Fáil's parliamentary party meeting on Wednesday that they're getting a backlash from supporters. "I'm not happy about it," says the chairman of the party, Brendan Smith. "The damage that the partition did to this country is the concern I'd have, and I would be happier if there wasn't a Fianna Fáil member of government going to it." He is joined by Niamh Smith, another Fianna Fáil TD for Cavan Monaghan. Barry Cowan says that the government is undermining President Higgins. And we also have Willie O'Dea, Cathal Crowe, Michael Moynihan and Fianna Fáil Senators Fiona O'Loughlin and Éireann McGreehan all complaining about the decision to send Jack Chambers and any other government figures to that as well. We're also told on the front page of the Sunday Times, on a budget note, that ministers in high-spending departments are bidding for more funds from Tuesday's budget after the forecast for the deficit this year was cut from $20 billion to $13 billion. Now it turns out the state is going to lose slightly less money this year, and as a result now there is slightly more money in the pot, and that has led to several ministers, we are told, being in robust discussions with the Minister for Public Expenditure, Michael McGrath, about how exactly they are going to deploy all of that money. We also learn again in seems to be a hallmark of me presenting this programme, because the very second week that I did this show was the week that Mark Tighe had a story about John Delaney's bridging loan to the FAI. He still has more revelations 2.5 years later. He tells us this morning that tens of thousands of euros in defamation settlements made with John Delaney were paid into a company with which he had no official link. A Sunday Times investigation has established that the FAI's longtime solicitors, A&L Goodbody, were directed by Delaney to transfer some of the proceeds of large legal settlements to a company called Pillarview Limited. It's been in liquidation since last December. It was co-owned and co-directed by two friends of Delaney's, but there was no suggestion of any wrongdoing on the part of Goodbody, but nor was there any official link between John Delaney and that company. So that company with which he had no official link was the beneficiary of some of the settlements that were made in his favour as a result of some of the coverage. The Sunday Independent, as you would expect, leads with some more budget speculation. We're told that creches and childcare facilities will be given more money to improve staff pay in return for freezing fees for parents under a scheme to be announced in Tuesday's budget. We're told that Roderick O'Gorman has secured approval for a significant new scheme that will see childcare providers given access to a funding stream to improve staff pay, but they'll only get it in return for a commitment that parents' fees will not increase. The government hopes that the move will alleviate the burden on parents by basically freezing creche fees at a time of rising inflation. That's the front page of the Sunday Independent. The Business Post says budget tax cuts of €250 amid concern over the rising cost of living. We're told that income tax bans and credits will be increased by 2-3% to take account of inflation, which is going to be worth around €250 a year to most workers. We're also told that the vacant site tax of 7% is going to be increased and applied to zoned land, which hasn't been built on for 2 years as part of an incentive for builders to get going on land that they do have that they're not yet turning the sod on. And also, anyone who's ever followed the story of Tony Tenn, who is a former Carlow post office worker who ran up massive gambling debts and who ended up also siphoning off money from his employers on pusts to fund his habit. What you might not have known up until now, and it's revealed in today's Business Post, is that Paddy Power repaid on pust almost €2 million stolen from it by that high profile gambler. That's part of a new book published by the Business Post, Aaron Rogan, which is going to be released later this month. And finally for now, the Irish Mail on Sunday: ex-Taoiseach's son linked to anti-Semitic sect. The son of the former Taoiseach John Bruton was, up until recently, involved in a right-wing anti-Semitic group led by a convicted Holocaust denier. An Irish Mail on Sunday investigation into Matthew Bruton, who is 39, confirms his involvement with SSPX Resistance, an extreme Catholic splinter group under investigation by Gardaí for hate speech. That is your potted tour of what's on the front pages of this morning's newspapers. We're joined by Sheena Cahill, who's a former president of the Union of Students in Ireland, and by Owen O'Malley from the School of Law and Politics in DCU. Good morning to you both. Owen, I don't know where to start with all the budget stuff, because it does seem like, despite the state being in what otherwise would be seen as fairly dire financial straits, that there's still an awful lot of pie going around and an awful lot of demands for it.
Yeah, seems to be money is all they talk about, even though there is going to be a deficit of about €13 billion this year. So we're taking in a lot less than we're spending. And one of the papers, I think in the Business Post, they point out that there could be the national debt will be $220 billion by this time next year. So it's going up and up and up.
Sure, what's a few billion between friends?
And there doesn't seem to be any huge demand to start thinking about how we're going to pay that down and cut that, because we're spending about 5 billion a year in servicing the national
Is that fair
debt.
Enough for the time being, though? Because if you have an economy that's only barely picking itself up again after a fairly dramatic 18 months, a lot of people would say it makes sense to try and borrow to get the fires going again now, and then maybe worry about the cost of it all a little bit further down the line.
Yeah, so certainly last year it made perfect sense, and I don't think anybody thought it was a bad idea to borrow at that time to kind of keep people, you know, in... keep people fed, essentially, when they weren't when so many people weren't working. But a lot of the reasons why we won't have a deficit of 20 billion and it'll only be 13 billion is because I think one minister is quoted as saying the economy is taking off like a rocket. So if the economy is taking off,
it's a phrase that Leo Varadkar used before, so I wonder who that minister might be.
Right. If it is taking off like a rocket, then maybe we don't need to keep borrowing to subsidize activities that may not otherwise happen. Those things will already be happening. The main problem in the economy seems to be that there are kind of supply constraints. So people can't get enough people working in bars and restaurants and things like that for various reasons, probably to do with pay. And so maybe the government should be starting to think about that. Instead, it is, you know, how much money will we get? And so 100 million for here and 200 million for there, which is always the way I think a lot of the time ministers think they're successful if they can just increase their budget, rather than kind of thinking about, can I come up with a good idea that will actually deliver a real good, something that we want, whether it is more spaces in childcare and or more treatments in hospitals. Instead, it's just success is measured as I got my budget up to 20 million. And so the health budget is now over 20 billion a year, which is an incredible amount of money. And I would think, given the continual rise over the last 20 or almost more than 20 years in real terms in the health budget, nobody's saying that the health system is fixed and working well now. So we should probably be starting to think about, let's spend less money and maybe get better deals for ourselves.
Are you basically saying, just before I bring Sheena in, are you basically saying that there needs to be someone with a little bit more of a grand vision for what they're going to do with all the money, that everyone is about trying to spin the plates that they've got, but no one really wants to do anything new?
Yeah, so there aren't... One of the things you don't see in the budget coverage there is huge, big ideas. There seems to be, we're going to secure our income and or we'll have another little scheme in order to do this. Another little scheme will do that. But they're not solving what are significant problems like the housing issue. And then, for instance, in the Business Post, there's a coverage of a letter from Dermot Desmond. And you'd think maybe he might be somebody you could listen to. I mean, he is literally the 1%. And if he's saying...
Apparently, they did listen to him. Apparently, we were told in that, aside from the letters that he sent to Dara O'Brien, that he did have a meeting with him on the 1st of April this year. So maybe, I don't know whether he was paying full attention given the date that it was, but that at least the government is at least paying some attention to what the likes of Dermot Desmond have to say.
Yes, but you don't see any grand plans there. It's just scheme after scheme. We'll have another. We're going to put 200 million into this scheme. I'm not sure that these are going to solve.
I'm sure there are ministers or the staff who are listening to this programme already, but smoke coming out of the rear, saying, but I have this big scheme. Look at all this inventive stuff that I'm doing. And I'm more than welcome them to get in touch at 53106 at a cost of 30 cents. I'm sure they all have my mobile number anyway. Sheena Cahill, there is an awful lot written in today's papers about all different aspects of the budget. Anything that jumps out for yourself this morning?
It's one of those things where I was thinking, you know, if we're looking at the economy, you're talking about it being something that takes off like a rocket. I think exactly jumping off what Owen just said there, where is the rocket going to land? Like if we're just that's great, it's in the sky, that's fantastic, let's shoot some schemes at it. But like, where does it go then after that? I mean, Brian Keegan in the Sunday Business Post kind of makes the point that Ireland doesn't do alarms or surprises on budget day. And I think that this is another example of that, where we're not going to get any grand plan. And it feels so, you know, and I'm not an economist. I'm the furthest from an economist you would get, like, but it does feel, and even from experience within student politics, where, you know, a scheme would be announced with the Department of Education and we'd, you know, welcome it. But the problem was that there was no planning into the future. Like, getting 1 million for the Student Assistance Fund is always welcome, but it doesn't it doesn't actually tackle in the problem, like, and that's what happens in budget every single year.
So it's
year,
kind of sticking plaster
like,
stuff. It's like always, right, giving money to UCC Students Union for its food bank,
yeah,
but not
it's
addressing
what's in
the
my
causes
patch.
Of hunger.
It's what's in my patch stuff. Like, it's, you know, it's what money and what scheme can I put in my constituency or in my department that I can sign off on. And obviously that's great in the here and now potentially, but it doesn't actually solve the greater budgetary issues around strategic planning that we need to actually be talking about.
Well, I suppose one thing I can imagine, if I can channel the ministerial special advisors who are probably sending me very frantic text messages right now, they'll probably say the budget day is not what it used to be, that it's now this grand process, that there's the summer economic statement and there's all this macroeconomic planning. So you don't ever get the big bolt of stuff on budget day. And they would say, right, let's look at housing. It's only a couple of weeks since the Housing for All plan was published. That they would consider is radical. So there's no need to do anything radical on budget day. All you have to do is pay for the measures that are already announced. So they would say that actually there is imagination. It's just not all about announcing it all in one day.
Yeah, I suppose the big reimagination is going to have to happen in that usual 45-minute speech from the department's minister, Pascal Donoghue, around how he's going to like reiterate now the difference in the corporation tax rate. That's usually the same line every year, and now it's going to be 15%.
It's one of those things that you used to be able to set your watch by, at which point in the speech would Pascal Donoghue say the 12.5% rate is not up for negotiation. Are you surprised at the fact that it's only 12 months since the last time he said that on the floor of the Dáil? He said this is a linchpin of our FDI strategy, of our global offering. And now we've just gone, don't need that anymore.
It did seem to go without a huge amount of debate. I suspect the Department of Finance wasn't going to move on this without having thought about it pretty deeply. I think in the Business Post again, the IDA chief executive, Martin Shanahan, says that, you know, we do have a lot more to offer than just that 12.5%. And it is true, or at least it seems to be true, that a lot of those very large multinationals never even paid the 12.5% anyway. So they paid some kind of small fraction of it. And so maybe the government is kind of quite confident that that headline figure isn't what brings foreign direct investment.
We'll be talking more about this after 12 o'clock because Ed Brophy, who used to be a special advisor to Pascal Donoghue, who's going to be talking to us just after 12, and we'll talk to him about it then. But it seems that in all the focus there's been on the corporate tax rate, that no one is paying very much attention to the other half of the deal, which is now that countries can tax profits based on where the money is paid rather than which company actually books it, which is a huge part of it.
Yeah, I mean, going to be very significant. So where we had essentially taken money from the German taxpayer or the Spanish taxpayer, that money net will now be paid in Germany or Spain, which means that...
And widely, we have no idea how much we're going to lose as a result of that. There's estimates, but everyone has different estimates and no one knows.
And I assume that there are going to be significant losses, which is another reason why the government might want to think about whether it just should spend all the money it has because it has it. And a little bit more. So that will be a significant problem next year, which we don't really know the size of.
Someone has tweeted in saying that you could hardly call it a budget at this stage because the government is flinging out truckloads of fivers to everyone who they think will vote for them. They can't provide adequate housing, healthcare, education, energy. It's like buying vouchers to McDonald's for a fella on death row, which is... That's a peak. That's as imagery goes for 17 minutes past 11. I think the show has already peaked just there. Thank you, Shaggy, for that. On the record, NT is our hashtag if you want to try and better that one. Sheena, why do you think there is a lack of imagination in people trying to come up with big ideas? You would think that if this is a new government, they're only into the second budget of five, you'd think they'd have the grand visions coming out of their ears at this stage, wouldn't you?
No, not at all. I think it's actually the opposite because everybody's so busy stabbing each other in the back and trying to announce things behind it before the other one does that there's no room for big ideas. Like you don't get big ideas in a coalition government that like don't play like a team.
So we need to have majoritarianism back again. Go back to the days of Jack Lynch.
No, that's not my suggestion. But like that's what we've been seeing. Like that is what we have been seeing for the last 18 months is, you know, lads coming out of meetings, smiling at a camera together. And then the next minute, someone is launching something behind someone else's back or a tweet goes out or a Facebook status or someone's talking to someone from the Indo and that's great. And they're announcing their scheme again. Like, that's not team playing. And so you don't get big ideas when people don't play together. And that I mean, you're talking about lack of imagination. I mean, here we are. The front of the Sunday Business Post is saying that there's going to be a rise in the third level student grant. As a former president of the Union of Students in Ireland, I should be jumping off some building with delight about this. But actually, instead, the reason why we're apparently doing that increase is to take account for the cost of rising student accommodation. What? That doesn't mean, that's not a good idea. Like, just to just increase this in order to pay for something that's wildly overpriced isn't a good idea. It doesn't, you know, that's again, not forward thinking, not future planning. We're just putting more money into the pockets of overpriced student accommodation, as an example.
They might say that they're just coming up from air after 18 months of the pandemic, and it's kind of difficult now. And so maybe this isn't the budget where they're looking forward, and it could be next year that they can reveal some sort of grant scheme. But I mean, you're right. A lot of the problems that we see in Irish society are down to housing costs. And if we could somehow tackle those, then, you know, student grants wouldn't be necessarily the issue, and funding for a lot of the other things, you know, pay for nurses and Gardaí and teachers, they wouldn't be an issue if people weren't spending ridiculous sums on paying their rents.
If the cost of living was that little bit lower. This might be the wrong time to point out that Killian Woods has a piece on page 16 of the Business Post today, pointing out that, in fact, you know, delivering more houses might not actually bring down the cost of housing, because the cost of actually delivering housing is so high now in some areas that they simply can't afford to sell it below a certain level, which unfortunately is unaffordable to most people.
That's a problem which we have in DCU. So we wanted to build more housing, but if we were to build more student accommodation, we would have to make it pay, we'd have to charge what seems to me to be a ridiculous sum.
It's a nasty one. Just before we go to the break, actually, Owen, because there's been a lot of opinion polls this week. We had yet another Ipsos Emer BI poll for the Irish Times, which has Sinn Féin 10 points ahead of Fine Gael, which is the most popular of the government parties. If there was going to be a time where you'd want to do something big and imaginative, I'm not saying that budgets, which are a long-standing thing, get framed by short-term opinion polls, but would you be right in thinking that the government feels the opposition really breathing down its neck now more than ever?
I'm sure it does, but it's been, I mean, the 10-point lead is kind of an artifact of the fact that there are two big government parties there. And so the government parties, I think, have 49%.
So you think if there was like a senior and a junior, that they'd still add up together?
Yeah,
I'm
not sure that, you know, they could even still be looking at it going, you might look at that. Yes, Sinn Féin is on 33% or so, but Sinn Féin's path to victory, or where it'll form a government from, isn't as clear as all that. I mean, and also I would think that the government is reasonably confident that it will last until 2025. So it's not going to start panicking midterm.
As long as there aren't TDs who are getting a little bit upset about the exclusion of certain roads from the National Development Plan, which we could talk about, but frankly, I'd be here all hour complaining about how much of a work of fiction that is. Lots more in the budget and corporation tax, as I said, with Ed Brophy after 12 o'clock. Also, if you're interested in a little bit more, an interesting discussion with Danny McCoy and Fergal O'Rourke about all of that on Taking Stock earlier with its new presenter, Mandy Johnston, who, by the way, I'd like to welcome her to Sunday mornings here on News Talk. Taking Stock now goes out at 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings, but you can already hear the podcast of that on the News Talk app. And also welcome to Sunday mornings, by the way, to Jonathan McRae, because Future Proof now goes out at 10 o'clock, as you might have heard a few minutes ago. And that's also available to listen back now on the News Talk app. Sheena Cahill and Owen O'Malley still with me in studio. We're going to talk health and how exactly it's run. And Owen, I might as well let you take the lead on this, because you have written in today's Sunday Independent about the decision to reform how Sláinte Care is done, which already strikes me as something of an anachronism, because you're reforming how they're going to reform, which is already one of the most Irish governmental ways you can ever go about things. But they're going to reform how they're reforming, because they've now decided to put Paul Reid and Robert Watt in charge of the Health Services Ambitious Programme. And you think, according to your piece, that the hostile takeover can work. Explain so.
I thought it was surprising. I mean, there was an interesting trip in the health Oireachtas Health Committee this week, where some past colleagues went kind of toe-to-toe and... Roisin Shortall described this as a hostile takeover, that the centre was taking control again of the reform of Sláinte Care. And she said this in a negative way, that this was a bad idea. And it seems to me that one of the mistakes that had been made by Leo Varadkar, one of his first acts as Taoiseach, I think, was not to have it directed from the centre. I mean, if you don't have the HSE and the Department of Health running the reform of the health service, then nobody will listen to it. So it was being given to Laura McGahey and Tom Keane, who by all accounts were competent, efficient and well-meaning.
And they were trying quite hard.
One of the problems possibly was that the civil service is very hierarchical, and you have somebody who is not your boss asking you to do things. you might kind of go a bit the way I do with a lot of emails that I receive, just ignore them. And
now we know how academia is truly run by just ignoring correspondence.
No, it's unless it says Dear Owen, I'm not going to respond.
So your point then is that unless the change is actually being commandeered by the people at the top of the tree, it's never going to happen.
Well, if you look at major pieces of reform that have happened in Ireland, what has happened since the 1980s, anything that got through and actually worked has come really from the Department of the Taoiseach. And the Department of the Taoiseach tends to chair a committee on delivery. And so I would suggest that he should be chairing a committee on the delivery of Sláinte Care, where he can call in Paul Reid, Stephen Donnelly and Robert Watt and kind of bang heads and say, where are things going?
Okay, so there's the one argument then that the change isn't going to happen unless the people who are empowered to make the changes are actually running it. And that's fair enough to a point. But if Paul Reid and Robert Watt are going to be the guys in charge of reforming the whole programme, isn't this like an almost literal case of physician heal thyself? Because they're going to be charged with reforming their own practices.
Yeah, well,
and Robert
Watt
even admitted this week that there's going to be a lot of resistance to that.
So there's a piece in the Mail on Sunday today saying that Robert Watt doesn't want to decentralise and that this was one of the issues.
Some of the resignations were prompted by him.
Yeah, and so that there's a sense that there's a resistance from the Department of Health. I don't know whether there is. Maybe he doesn't want to decentralise, but I suspect that there is no resistance to this. And so in my piece in the Sunday Independent, I do say that one of the things that Sláinte Care did early was it agreed principles. And so politicians agreed a set of principles that people would, there'd be universal access to healthcare. You would not pay at the point of treatment. And everybody agreed to that. But for that to happen, then you have to do things. So we're taking private practice out of public hospitals. In order to do that, we have to renegotiate consultants' contracts. How do you renegotiate consultants' contracts? You have to compensate them because the consultants are probably losing money. Are they going to give up this?
Because now they're allowed to work for private as well. And now you're trying to get them not to do that. So you're going to have to pay them for their time and so on.
Are they going to do that for free? Probably not. So they might say, oh, there's resistance from the Department of Health because the Department of Health isn't willing to chuck money at us in order to compensate us. The Department of Health might say, well, we're protecting the taxpayer here.
This, by the way, this is a real adjunct observation to all of that, but Robert Watt must be having a very unusual budget week, because ordinarily for the last 10 years, he's been sitting in the Department of Public Expenditure deciding what can be signed off on and what hasn't. And now he's on the other side of the fence going, can we have some more money, please?
And I presume he knows exactly how to get it and where it is. Yeah. So he might be in a good position for health. I mean, and then there are other issues there that you have with Sláinte Care that everybody says everybody should be eligible. But if you're making everybody eligible, I mean, you're a recent parent, you'll probably see a sniffly nose and kind of go and start panicking and say, oh, bring the child down to the GP, where in a couple of years, you'll realise that I should never have bothered bringing this child to the GP. And so you end up filling GP surgeries with people who don't need to be there. And then do you have elderly people, people with chronic illnesses who should be at the GP and should be getting quick access, now having to sit and wait in queue? And so a lot of people kind of cite the NHS as a kind of an ideal type of health service.
There's waiting lists there as well, though, isn't there?
Yeah, so there you have lots of waiting lists. You have to wait weeks to see a GP, by which time most people have probably gotten better by themselves.
Sheen, I'm going to put you in charge now of reforming the health service, so good luck with that. The way your face just dropped, I only wish this was being live streamed, because the way the panic that just rose so viscerally on your face
my chair started rolling away. the microphone.
What I was going to say was, is this not a perfect example of the imagination that you were decrying in part one? This is a perfect example of an imaginative proposal which doesn't even have any political resistance because everyone wants it. So why doesn't something like this actually come to pass?
This is because this is about ideas versus delivery. And I think, obviously, it's never a good thing when you have like a bunch of like really well-qualified, very well-respected people in their fields drop off like flies from an implementation type group that, what is it, SIAC, the Sláinte Care Implementation Advisory Council is. I do think that there does seem to be some debate, and I'm hearing Owen on the positioning of, you know, who, if you're coming up with the ideas or you're being an advisor, do you have the capacity to actually make the decisions? And therefore bringing it closer to the decision-making system with Robert Watt and Paul Reed makes sense in that context. I suppose my query over it is, who keeps them responsible for the actions that they might take?
The Taoiseach.
That's what you would. That's what you'd hope.
The argument was that there isn't the political bandwidth in the Department of the Taoiseach, which, despite its grand title, is not actually a very big department because everything is operationally managed by everyone else. Is there actually enough space? Is there enough brain power in the department to oversee something as gargantuan as reforming an entire health service, especially when there's already a department that's there to run health anyway?
I mean, as long as the Department of the Taoiseach doesn't try to second guess everything that has been, every decision that's been made and information that's coming from each of the departments. The Department of the Taoiseach has a problem when it doesn't trust other departments and it doesn't believe them, what they're saying. Then it does need to have more people. Mm. But it's got, 230 people. It doesn't need huge numbers. It just needs the political pressure and to put that political focus on something. And so it would, if you are being called into the Department of the Taoiseach, you know that you have to have something to show for them. And you know that the Taoiseach can kind of put pressure on you and can make this something that needs to be delivered. You can't turn up to those meetings with nothing to show. Mm. So I don't think you need to have a huge number of people in the department. You just need a department like okay. that. It can only focus on probably five or six issues at any one go. And so it's up to the department, up to the Taoiseach then to pick what are the issues that I really care about. Mm. And how am I going to try and push these
Well,
forward?
Which he's done, I suppose, for the likes of Shared Island. So maybe that's a precedent that you can have the Department of the Taoiseach taking over a lot of this. I am mindful that some listeners probably hear of talk about civil servants and their eyes glaze over because these are personalities in lofty towers. They don't know them. They don't ever see them on telly. And that's kind of fair enough. But there's one point which is made in the Mail on Sunday piece that you mentioned, Owen, which is worth reflecting on, which is whether Robert Watt might actually be the right person to put in charge, because in some people's eyes, this is the fox in charge of the hen house. There's an argument, or an account rather, in this piece of somebody who was from the now departing Sláinte Care Advisory Council, who was in a meeting with the government a couple of days ago. The Sláinte Care source revealed this weekend that when asked recently who was in charge of Sláinte Care in a meeting with SIAC, Health Minister Stephen Donnelly answered, "That's a really good question. I'm not entirely sure what the answer is. I'll have to get back to you on that." The source described the minister as completely lost when it came to Sláinte Care. There is a real vision coming out of that Sláinte Care has actually been held captive by the Department of Health and by the senior figures in it, and that it's never going to happen under their watch because they have too much skin in the game in trying to keep things more comfortably as they are.
I'm not sure that the Department of Health is looking at the current system and saying, "Oh, this is great, let's keep it that way." Mm. I'm not sure that anybody has a huge interest in maintaining the health system. They possibly don't. You could see how somebody may not want to embark on a big reform package because maybe reform is quite a bit of work. I assume the thinking behind putting Robert Watt in there was that you were going to have somebody who was a gamekeeper going in to look after, to take care of the poachers. And,
well, I suppose it was also the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform, so he has some experience of breaking eggs to make an omelette.
Mm. So I'm not sure why people think that the Department of Health is resistant to reform. I suspect that what we have here is, as Sheena said, I mean, you can agree a set of principles and ideas, but then implementing them is different. And when you have implementation, you have conflict.
Anthony points out on Twitter that it might be interesting to know if any of the decision makers, given the job of Sláinte Care, have any financial interests in private hospitals or consultancy practices, etc. Which is, I'm not making any accusations at any of the people who are now departing from that committee, but there is a few different consultants who you might argue will be better off financially from the current situation, where they can do some private work as well as public. Stephen on Twitter says that Owen saying that there's no resistance to Sláinte Care only after all of their independent stakeholders implementing it had resigned. They hardly left because they didn't like the tea.
But they weren't really an implementation body. It was more of an advisory body.
Who was responsible for implementing it?
Well, I suspect
then?
That's what they... I think that's what they were saying was probably... What government is saying is the problem. It is that they put Laura Magahy in charge without giving her
the tools to actually carry it out.
To do it. Mm. She wasn't hierarchically high enough to make that happen. And so, and then put her in charge of this body called the implementation body, but possibly didn't give her enough going on. And then people are saying, oh, you know, the decentralisation didn't happen where it should have happened. But I think it's not unreasonable for the Department of Health to make the argument that it was the middle of a pandemic. We weren't going to start moving everything around at that time when all hands were on deck.
Everyone had other things on their plate, certainly. We have a few minutes before the next ad break, and Sheen, I wanted to pick your brain about one of the other issues which is featuring in a lot of the papers today, which is the large protest that there was in Dublin yesterday about the proposed development in Temple Bar, which would involve Merchant's Arch, and also the development in Smithfield, which would involve some of the downsizing of the Cobblestone Pub, which people might know as being a real traditional music venue there. Seems that a lot of people are very, very now motivated. They feel like they're really striking a chord with a city which has maybe gone too far in trying to cater to tourists and not to residents.
Yeah, I mean, people are angry. I'm angry. I live just up the road from the Cobblestone. In fact, my first date with my now fiance was in the Cobblestone. Now, aside from that,
so it needs to be kept for to have a blue plaque outside.
And a UNESCO heritage site stamp for that reason only. Aside from that, right? Like, I think it just speaks. I think the anger around these two specific locations. That you're seeing from people, a huge protest yesterday that ended up, I think, at the county council offices in Dublin. It is just really capturing the mood of people in Dublin at the moment around the erasure and deletion off the map and the downgrading of what are really important cultural spaces, gathering places, gig locations, nightclubs, whatever you want to call it, in favour of this like soulless hotel, like manufacturing business that we have become excellent at in Dublin city centre. Like, you can't throw a stone without hitting some kind of like hotel chain at the moment. And like, we like on News Talk and elsewhere, we're talking about every week, talking about the issues of antisocial behaviour growing in Dublin city centre, the concerns around whether Dublin is really a livable city, the drinking culture, etc. And yet we're not really pausing to look at why all of those things are happening simultaneously to the fact that we are plotting out a city centre that doesn't have the kind of footfall for families. It doesn't have spaces for recreation. It is reliant on retail that obviously closed entirely in terms of front facing during COVID. And instead, you can give out about the streets running amok, but if we are allowing a situation where we're like clearing spaces that of cultural significance of any kind to put in a hotel, another hotel, where once again we're putting in tourists paying far too much in a crappy room to go out, as someone said during the week, on a whatever 3-hour bus journey to take a picture at the Cliffs of Moher and come back again. It's not the experience that we want them to have.
God, you said
and it's
so
not
well.
The experience that we want to have in our city centre in Dublin.
Owen, on that, there's the argument, of course, that this is, you know, urban heritage and culture being sold down the Swanee. But then there's also an argument that cities evolve over time, and not every pub which is ever opened or which is fond to people or which is the first place in which someone met their now fiance can ever keep its doors open forever, and that the natural habit of cities is that they have to evolve to survive, and this is maybe not the way people would like it to, but it's just part of natural urban evolution.
Yeah, so I think there seem to be two questions which are sometimes being conflated. One, a lot of people were complaining about the overdevelopment, and so they were saying that, you know, these were nice little two-story homes with pubs underneath them, and now they're going to become 6 or 7 stories. And the other thing is then, are they all going to become hotels? I'd be pretty comfortable with what other people call overdevelopment. I think it's development. I think it's reasonable to have 6 or 7 stories in the city centre. Whether we need, when we have serious problems with housing, whether we need to change the incentive structure for developers to make it less likely that they want to build the hotels and things like that, and more likely to want to build apartments that people will move into.
Like, one thing I'm struck by in all of this, that it's now, I think it's 2 years this month since all the furore about the closure of the Bernard Shaw pub in Portobello because it was going to be redeveloped. And I drove past it this morning, as I do every week when I came in here. 2 years this month, and they haven't turned the sod or done anything to the previous facade. They shut down what was a much beloved, perhaps maybe overrepresented in the media sector, but it was a much beloved night spot, you know, a really innovative sort of nightclub culture sort of area. And it closed it. And 2 years later, they've done nothing. They closed a venue for no ostensible reason at all.
Well, except you can still go there because it's still in Phibsborough. There's a place called the Bernard Shaw. So it didn't close as a
So they could have had two of them.
They could have had two of them. And so this is now, you can see the government is starting to do things where it will introduce the vacant site levy, where there will be 7%, which is a pretty significant tax on the, presumably on the value of the land. If they don't do anything in 2 years. Now, my fear with these things is you can always go in and throw a JCB in there for a day and take it out and say, oh yeah, we did some work. And so how easy it is to get around paying that vacant site levy will be significant.
Because I don't think that this is about a fear of progress. I think this is a genuine concern about what that progress apparently looks like to the planners of Dublin City Council, allowing like these types of hotels. And again, it's not apartments. It's not something that's going to alleviate an issue, a housing crisis that we have. It's instead putting more tourism into the city, which everyone recognises is economically a benefit. But where are these people going to hang out? Like, is everybody going to just spend €8 a pint in Temple Bar? There'll be no cultural institutions. There'll be no like beautiful street art as you walk along. There'll be no gigs. We're pushing everything out of the city centre, and we're pushing the people of Dublin out of the city centre. And I don't think that's appropriate.
I think it's an outbreak, but I mean, the cobblestone pub isn't going to close. It might be slightly curtailed or strained back at their beer garden.
It'll be residence bar, and I don't think anyone's going to love that.
But one thing that does strike me about all of this as well is that, look, I know there's been a pandemic, so it's not like Dublin has been swamped with international tourists for the last couple of years. But how much have we read in the last 12 months or so about how Dublin hotels are almost struggling to get by and how much of a room vacancy rate there is? Like, I'm just not convinced that the market is actually there to sustain that many more hotels, particularly the prices that Dublin charges for them.
No, I don't. And like, a friend of mine had come over, it was pre-COVID, and it was at a time when we'd had a building boom around hotels even at that point. And he stayed, he really struggled to find somewhere that was affordable in Dublin city centre, never mind anything else. So apparently with all the hotels we are building, it's not getting any cheaper to stay here.
Mind you, there's always been that element of things, because I'm going to a gig somewhere in England next year and you cannot get an affordable gig. It's not in London. It's not anywhere close to an urban centre. You cannot get a hotel room for anything less than several limbs. So it's not a unique thing to Ireland. I've had a tweet from Anthony O'Connor, who was one of the members of the Sláinte Care Implementation Advisory Council, who stepped down from that earlier this week. He says that there was innuendo from Gavin Riley that his or any resignation from SIAC was in any way motivated by private practice. He says it's real chief stuff, which is easily disproved by a 30-second Google search. But it's interesting to note that the same old tired briefing lines are smeared and being trotted out as ever. For the record, I hope I caveated it at the time, but I want to say again that there was no innuendo intended on the part of casting aspersions as to Anthony's resignation or that of anyone else. Just somebody did make an observation that maybe there might have been some conflicting loyalties among some members of the council, but certainly didn't intend to single anyone out or to suggest anything other than the highest actions of good faith on the part of Anthony O'Connor or anyone else. Sheena Cahill and Owen O'Malley are still with me going through the rest of the Sunday papers. There was a lot written, a lot of it before last night's match, I hasten to add, about whether it was appropriate to choose Callum Robinson to appear in the Ireland international football team. I hasten again to add, before he scored two of the goals in Ireland's 3-0 win over Azerbaijan last night. But it does raise a question, Owen, about whether it's appropriate to give positions of high esteem or positions which carry a certain level of role model, that kind of status, to people who haven't been following the established science, so to speak, on vaccinations.
Yeah, given that we all knew it was going to be a story and it had already been a story, putting him out there during the week seemed odd to advertise the fact that he hadn't taken it, had still been refusing a vaccine. In the papers today, Declan Lynch in the Sunday Independent and Brenda Power both have a go at him and are kind of very much on the side that, you know, he shouldn't have been allowed to go on. There does seem to be a kind of a lecturing and hectoring tone, which I'm not sure if I were a kind of vaccine skeptic, the lecturing and hectoring tone would be appropriate. I presume we don't get, unfortunately, the sports supplements, but I assume the sports supplements sub-editors have gone with double jab.
There's a lot of that. The shot in the arm on the front page of the Sunday Times. There is double jab elsewhere. Full digest with Joe Malloy later on and off the ball.
So Robinson might feel, you know, what's the knee? He can get COVID twice and it hasn't done him too much harm. So, I mean, in a way, he is obviously some sort of, kind of a victim of misinformation, in that he believes that he's going to get sick or it will impact his virility.
Well,
in some way.
One thing which I thought was a little bit unfortunate about all of this week was that he wasn't given an opportunity or invited to explain why he hadn't done. The press conference, or the bits that were aired from the press conference, seemed to be, I haven't got it done yet, but nobody invited him to extrapolate as to why that was the case, whether it was concern that he'd have an adverse reaction that would keep him out of his work for a week or two. Nobody seemed to ask him where it was, and it was a shame that people were kind of then presupposing his motives.
Yeah, and so we could have then had a debate, because presumably if he's contracted COVID twice, presumably he has been out of work for a week or two then. So,
because he's mismatches though too, right?
Presumably, yeah. He has. Yeah, and so I mean, it doesn't make a huge amount of sense to me, but I still think that, I mean, Ger Colleran in the Mail says, you know, comparing Ja refusal to drink driving is being kind to drink drivers.
Or it's
been harsh on drink drivers, yeah. Rather. And I just kind of think that, again, this is more lecturing and hectoring for people who are reading other stuff, probably on Facebook. Mm. And if they then turn around and kind of mainstream media is kind of telling them that they're wrong, it might make them less likely to be convinced rather than more likely to be convinced of taking
Why do you think, Sheena, that there's been so little scope or any kind of generosity afforded to the likes of Callum Robinson to maybe understand why he hasn't, that maybe he's got professional reasons why he doesn't want to risk an adverse reaction, at least in the middle of a playing season, and that everyone just seems to be looking down upon him for not having exercised his liberty the same way that everyone else did?
And he had the same liberty to come out and clarify the story if he wanted to this week, even before the match. I mean, sure, it's his decision not to take the vaccination. It's a decision that impacts his team, and it impacts people who look up to him. And I think that's relevant. I'm not calling for his head. I'm not calling for him not to be played. But I think it's really interesting when you read like Brenda Parrish's remarks about the fact that 10 members of the 26-man Ireland football squad have not been vaccinated.
That's a higher uptake rate among the Ireland squad than there is for a lot of Premier League clubs. So yeah, I think there's only 7 out of the 20 that have more than half of their players fully jabbed.
Really?
Yeah, well, so I believe.
Yeah, and like, I think we're allowed to be disappointed by that. I think I'm not about the lecturing and hectoring that Owen's talking about, in fairness. And I think Eamon Sweeney, actually, in the back of their, or inside in the Sunday Independent, he's kind of fed up with this lecturing stuff, and he's kind of saying, look, why do we even care about what, you know, this soccer player who's very good, who obviously saved the game in some way last night, gave Stephen Kenny a shot in the arm, so to speak, or whatever. Why do we care about how he reacts to, you know, something that maybe is political or healthcare related? But I do think that we're allowed to be disappointed that someone who young people look up to, that players look up to, the players play with, has made a decision that puts other people at risk. I think, and it has been led by misinformation. I think we're allowed to be disappointed.
Is there
that
as much of a risk when he's already been already contracted the virus twice, and then therefore he has the same kind of, he has more natural immunity than most people have as induced by a vaccine, and that he's a lot less likely to shed it to other people then?
Yeah, but he's not a GP, and neither am I. And I think you'd still be better off, you know, stepping up and being part of the solution rather than saying that it's all right for me to have missed 2 Ireland games, you know, due to COVID. Because I'd rather stand over that. When obviously he came back last night, and you know, we clearly needed him. And I think it was Eamon Sweeney said, you know, or maybe it was Gavin Cooney actually, said, you know, during the week that like there's no you can never really kind of plan consistency around Ireland players scoring goals because we don't really
well,
do that often.
That's it. And if he's an informed striker, you can't afford to drop him. For
at the same time, I think, yeah, it's annoying actually. I'll just be honest. That's how I feel about it.
A colleague, by the way, who was at that press conference with the FAI earlier this week, has just been in touch with me personally. He says that Callum Robinson was asked to elaborate why he had chosen not to take it, but he chose not to do so. So he was invited to give an explanation, and he chose not to do so given the forum that he had. We are almost out of time, but she and I introduced you as a former president of USI. Your day job now is with Ongashka, the President's Award, and you have a little bit of a plug to get in before you go.
I do, just very quickly. So Ongashka, the President's Award, we're celebrating and marking our 35th anniversary this year, and obviously Ongashka is for 14 to 26 year olds. It's a self-empowerment award, but this year, marking the 35th anniversary, we've distributed over 500,000 pollinator friendly bulbs in one of the largest
pollination campaigns in Ireland, and we gave out bulbs to all post-primary schools and local development offices around the country. And so now we're asking people to go to the local garden centre, pick out a pollinator-friendly bulb, plant it, and you can sign up to get a commemorative certificate with the Gashka Award.
This is where ordinarily I would have coined a pre-quipped gag of, because it's Gashka, going, what do you want, a medal? But actually, now that I know that what you're plugging, it's actually quite a worthwhile thing. So maybe I'll drop that cynicism for the moment. Bulbs for Bees. Sheena Cahill, former president of USI, now involved with Gashka, and Owen O'Malley from the School of Law and Government at DCU. Thank you both very much for coming in to go through the Sunday papers this morning.
On the Record with Gavin Riley. On News Talk.